Blog Talk Radio.
Over there's the water. Whoosh, whoosh. And look at all this stuff I'm standing on. It's called sand, and it's everywhere.
This woman may sound silly to you and me.
It's made up of little tiny pieces of rocks. Teeny little pieces of rocks.
But to her 2-year-old son exploring the world around him, she makes perfect sense.
How does it feel when you touch the sand? Is it warm?
Uh-huh.
It's hard to hold in your hand, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Learning starts long before school does, and children are naturally curious. They want to learn, so follow their lead. Take simple, everyday moments, like sorting laundry or playing on the beach, and turn them into learning moments.
Is this water?
No.
Very good. This is sand. Oh, no, it's not food. It's sand. We don't eat sand.
Turn everyday moments into learning moments. Find out how at foreignlearning.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Morning with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, send me an email. I would love to hear from you. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@Hotmail.com. I want to say thank you so much for tuning in. We're past 760,000 downloads of the podcast. Wow, I really appreciate your support. I hope that you have enjoyed the shows. We've had artists on here, politicians on here, musicians, and health issues from lupus, multiple sclerosis, cancer. I hope they have all been helpful. Today, an awesome, wonderful show. I am so blessed to have three guests on the show. I have Lauren Mandel. She's the author of Eat Up. She's talking about rooftop urban gardening. Good morning, Lauren.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for calling in. Her book is called Eat Up, and I'm going to be giving away some copies of her book, so make sure you follow me on Twitter or become a fan on Facebook. Also, I have Adam Hill. He's the City Harvest Coordinator at the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society's City Harvest Program. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
And lastly, but not least, Mike Hill. He works for the USDA Forest Service. He's on the line as well from D.C. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you all for calling in this morning. I know most people are sleeping in, but I appreciate you getting up and willing to share your knowledge. You all are doing some great work in the United States, empowering youth, providing food and resources to people on this important movement of urban gardening. And for Lauren, she's doing rooftop gardening. I want to start off actually with Lauren. You have a wonderful book. It's called Eat Up. As I mentioned before, it's very easy to understand, talking about the history, where people are doing it, what you need to start a rooftop garden, talk about scale, the size from just a pot, a couple of pots to, hydroponics, all kinds of things I don't even know about. So congratulations on creating this book. How long did it take you to write the book?
I wrote the book 5 times in total, so the 5th version was what was finally published. I wrote the first draft when I was in graduate school for landscape architecture, and from that point to publication took about 3.5 to 4 years altogether. And during that time, I was very fortunate in being able to interview the real leaders of the rooftop agricultural movement, everyone from the rooftop gardeners and farmers themselves, to the CEOs of rooftop farming companies, chefs who are involved in the movement, volunteers, all sorts of folks who make this movement a reality.
Now, explain to the audience, what is rooftop gardening and how is that different than, say, what else is going on the ground level, so to speak?
So the umbrella term that I use in my book, Eat Up, is rooftop agriculture, which encompasses both rooftop gardening and rooftop farming. And rooftop gardening, and I think some of our other guests probably have differing opinions on what the difference is between gardening and farming, but for the purpose of my book, I side with the viewpoint that differentiates the two with regard to the fact that farming brings into account the commercial aspects of production, whereas gardening is generally intended for the production of vegetables for self-consumption, for gifting, for charity. So that's really the distinction that I draw in the book.
Adam, now you're working with the City Harvest Program with the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, and you're working with a really great program I'd like to highlight, which is the Roots to Reentry. Can you talk about that program a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So the Roots to Reentry program is a program run at the Philadelphia prison system up on State Road in the Northeast. And we actually have a farm up there that I manage. It's about like an acre and a half, so it's a fairly big farm. And we have a crew of inmates that works out there, and we grow a whole bunch of food, and we donate it to different soup kitchens and food cupboards around the city. And that part of the program goes on year-round. And then in the spring, we have what's like the proper Roots to Reentry program. And we do a training course that starts at the prison for about 5 weeks, and we have 15 inmates each session. And they go through and they work with me and other PHS staff and corrections officers and get, you know, hands-on training at the farm up there and the greenhouse, as well as some classroom training with just, like, life skills, math, stuff like that. And then if they do well in that, then we put them out on a work release, and they do further landscape training for about 6 weeks at Friends Hospital. And then if they do well there, then we can set them up with entry-level landscaping jobs with some of the contractors that PHS works with. So it's a great program. It really creates a lot of good green jobs for these guys who need to work and need to get their lives back on track.
It's an awesome program, and that's why I wanted to have you on. For the listeners, you can call in 646-929-0368. Also, the different websites I'll be posting, if you want to check out the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, the U.S. Forest Service Program, Just for Kids, I posted that on Twitter and on Facebook. And also Lauren's page, EatUp page, I posted that for you guys. But again, you can call in 646-929-0368. Mike Hill, let's bring you in the conversation. What are you doing over there in the Forest Service, and how are you connected, say, with urban gardening, or what is the connection that your program has?
Well, I think that the Forest Service is actually doing a little bit of everything. One thing that we have a big presence in state and private forestry, so a lot of the forestry and tree preservation efforts that may be going on in a listener city are actually supported through the Forest Service and supported by financial support and expertise that the Forest Service National Organization gives to state forestry offices. What we do in terms of trying to reach out to kids, we have a very active conservation education program. There are efforts that we operate directly, and there are efforts that we operate with our partners, and I'm just going to talk about a couple of things that we do. One big thing that we do is Discover the Forest, which is a partnership with the Ed Council about educating and connecting audiences, particularly diverse audiences, to public land. That's an online presence, and you can go on there and do everything from download information about how to teach your kids about plants or small curriculum pieces to finding out what public and what public parks or national parks are near you so that you can actually go out and have an experience on public land. The project that I work probably most closely on is the Children's Forest Project. For about 3 years, the Forest Service has been working with individual units to support those units developing big networks in their region with nonprofit and for-profit and local government actors to connect people to healthy outdoor recreation, to connect people with new options in terms of educational and career options that are environmentally focused and green focused, to provide education for people who educate our young people, whether they're educators in schools or informal educators like counselors or people who work in parks and recreation or people who work in museums, to connect them with the resources on public lands and really just connecting communities to their public lands.
Mike, just for time's sake, I just want to interject a little bit here. let's just talk a little bit about the history of urban gardening, that this is not some new thing. It's not just for hippies. It's not just for young people. I appreciate, Mike, you explaining the different programs, Adam, and also explaining your program. But let's talk that this actually has happened in the past. Lauren, in your book, you talk about the Victory Gardens. Also, I was reading in a presentation by a young woman named Lawson. She was doing a presentation. A lot of other Depression area times, urban gardening was ignited for need bases. Lauren, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so during the wars, people did start growing their own food, really for food security. There was not a lot of other food that was available in a consistent way at that time. And what we see right now is really interesting because there's a definite resurgence of urban gardening right now. And so people are starting to grow food, in their backyards, in vacant lots, next to the sidewalk, on fire escapes, and, of course, on rooftops as well. And what we're seeing is an incredible variety of different ways that people are growing food in these different spaces. And oftentimes this food is supplemental to that they're buying in the store. But sometimes they're actually growing most of the food that they eat in urban settings, which is really remarkable. And I see this trend as just getting stronger and stronger over time. And I think we're going to continue to see even more interesting ways that people are growing food in cities.
Now, Adam, your program, The Roots to Reentry, you said you're giving food to community organizations. That's an important issue because talking about food security, food wastelands in a lot of urban cities, there are not grocery stores that have fresh fruits and vegetables. There may not be fruit trucks. There are a lot of sparse, as they call them, wastelands that don't have good food. How many people do you impact with the program in terms of providing? How many people do you provide food with, you think, on a yearly basis? Do you know?
The City Harvest Program, which is our main program, it works with about 120 different sites around the city who we support with seedlings, seeds, organic pest control kits, growing supplies, soil, compost, and technical support. And those growers then, in return for that support, they donate food to local food cupboards that we hook them up with because we have a partnership with a share food program. So they are able to donate food locally to a food cupboard in their neighborhood. And we estimate that feeds about 1,200 families each week during the 8-month growing season. Provides
that's
all of their,
great.
Their vegetable needs.
That's a really awesome thing because we have a large obesity problem. Lauren, you talk about that in your book. It's mentioned on the horticultural website. Obesity is a big issue, so urban gardening, rooftop gardening are ways to help stop that or pause it because people have to get outside, they're getting fresh air, they're getting sunlight, and they're getting the produce that's developed. Now, Mike, in terms of environmentally, how do you teach the kids about how the forest and plants and trees affect or can improve the environment?
Well, one thing that I would say is that if you ask the average person where their water comes from, they're going to tell you it comes from the water department. And actually, your water comes from the forest.
It doesn't come from the water department? Doesn't come out of my sink?
And especially if you're in New York, in New York City, the reason why the city of New York owns big tracts of land in upstate New York is to protect their water supply and give you that champagne quality that people talk about when they talk about New York water. So the Forest Service recognizes a couple things. And one is that our nation is only getting more diverse. Within the next century, we'll live in a country where there is no majority. It'll be a majority-minority country, but there will be no clear majority in terms of ethnicity. And that a lot of those people are not connected with their public lands. Getting back to urban gardening, one of the things that the Forest Service and USDA as a whole also recognizes is that for a lot of people, especially kids, their first exposure to nature, both for convenience sake and for the realities of funding, has to be something close to home or close to school, and that community garden is that place. Community gardens are great places to give people hands-on education about the way the natural world works. And once you educate people, what I always say is that people who know about beer don't drink Natty Bug. they drink good beer. And if you educate people about, if you educate people about what it means to have a clean, safe environment, if you educate people about what plants do to mitigate urban heat islands, to reduce pollution at in places where there's a lot of roadways, when you educate people about the role trees play in shading their house and protecting their houses from impacts of weather, then people start to say they demand that.
Yeah, and I think that's the key issue there. Yeah, education is key. I mean, I was talking to Lauren, like, her book is awesome. I learned so much reading her book and going through and just like, wow. One of the things that I learned was what you need to start a rooftop garden, Lauren, and you need to talk with a lot of different consultants. You know, you need to talk to people in plumbing, electricians, all types of things. Lauren, could you just talk about what you need to start the garden? Also money. I'm sorry, that's just a small part there. You need money.
Yeah, you do. Not that much money necessarily. Depends on what exactly you're trying to do. So one of the things that my book has, which I find to be pretty useful for readers, is it has these really helpful checklists. And there's a checklist for rooftop gardening, a checklist for rooftop farming, and a checklist for the rooftop agriculture industry. So if you're interested in starting a company that has multiple rooftop locations or something like that. So in terms of gardening, the checklist basically includes taking a look at the building codes that are in your local area, taking a look at the building below, so the structural capacity, and making sure that the structure is approved by a structural engineer. And then once you're up on the roof, making sure that you have the right amount of sunlight, that you're not getting too much wind, that you have a water hookup that's available and that works properly. And then making sure that you understand the placement of where you're putting your planters or your raised beds. And then after that, you get into sort of the nitty-gritty, so thinking about the soil mix that you're going to use, what type of plants you're going to put in, what kind of gardening schedule you're going to work out. So that's really the basics of rooftop gardening.
Now, I also read in your book, Walmart has this huge, and I know a lot of people have a problem with Walmart, but you highlighted something positive in Chicago. Talk about their rooftop, what they're doing on their rooftop there.
Sure. So the company that I work for, which is called Roof Meadow, which is a green roof company based out of Philadelphia, we work all around the country. We design green roofs for Walmart in places like Chicago. And Walmart, one of their roofs, actually is the largest green roof research site in the world. So they collect a tremendous amount of data from that site, and it's not used to grow produce. It's used just as a thin green roof system to manage stormwater. But a lot of great research has come out of this test site, which provides a lot of information about how a green roof affects the building below in terms of controlling climate, mitigating stormwater, all sorts of good stuff like that.
Now, Adam, in terms of the human impact, how it impacts people, how they feel about themselves in connection to the earth, what have been responses from either the prisoners that have worked in your program and then they got out of prison, or have you gotten comments also from the people who tasted the food? What are some things that you've heard?
Well, just for the inmates, I mean, it's an amazing process to see them change. Like, some of the young guys who come into the program, they seem like they're out of it. They don't want to be there. And then, you know, a week later, just working with living plants, I mean, even for me, like, putting a seed in soil and watching it grow into food that then you eat is just, it's still, like, miraculous, you know? So it's a really nice process for them to see and be a part of. Obviously, the food that you grow is going to be way better than anything you have at Kirk's store. So a lot of times in those neighborhoods, when people taste the, you know, the onions or the tomatoes or collard greens or cucumbers that you grow yourself, it's just an amazing difference in the taste and the quality and everything. And then I just wanted to say, back to the green roofs thing, I love the idea of green roofs. And I was just going to say that in Philadelphia, we want to work with green roofs, but at the same time, there's so much vacant land in the city that it's almost, you know, there's 44,000 city-owned vacant lots around the city that we'd much rather start doing that first than working with the green roofs. But that's a great start also.
Well, there's so many programs going on. That's why I have all three of you different avenues, different mediums to try to help the environment, help get food, educate. You know, all these things are important. But then there's so many ways to get to the same goal, which is improving our environment, you know, providing the food. And economics is another important issue that that we haven't brought up, which is the difference between gardening and farming that Lauren brought up of, you know, making money actually. Keeping money local in the communities is important, and improving the local economy by having urban gardening or rooftop gardening. In Lauren's book, she talks about restaurants that have rooftop gardens. She talks about, you know, really large scale, like almost an acre. One of the pictures, I think it's Gotham City. I'm not sure if that's correct. That have a huge rooftop garden. But I wanted to bring Mike in the conversation. Talk about how people can connect their children to your services. Is there a phone number they can call, Mike? Should they just go to the website?
The best thing to do would be to access our programs and services through the web, because you can get, they're typically programs that are national in scope, and the web is the best way to filter down from the national level to what's happening close to your area. So the site that you posted just for kids, which is the National Children's Forest landing page, if your listeners go to that page, they can find the Children's Forest project that's in their area or near somewhere where they're going on vacation, find out what's going on at that Children's Forest, and connect with those programs. There's also a national program that promotes community garden at the USDA level. We're a sub-agency of the USDA, the People's Garden Program. And they do a lot of work to network and connect community gardens nationally. The last thing that I would mention is there's a great nonprofit that we work with, Project Learning Tree. Project Learning Tree has a green schools curriculum. This is a program that's really new. We piloted it with them about 5 years ago with four schools in Washington, D.C. Now there's over 2,000 schools nationally, and it's a curriculum.
Oh, awesome. That's great.
It's a curriculum that teachers can just take. It's a boxed curriculum. They can access it, and it basically takes your kids through the same kind of investigation that architects and designers and contractors and landscape architects would do if they were doing a LEED building, which is leadership and environmental engineering and design. Now, the great thing about...
I'm sorry, Mike. We're just running out of a little bit of time. I want to mention that in the chat room. Thank you guys for participating in the chat room. People are talking about they have recycled bottles. One of the things that Lauren talks about in her book are the different types of containers that people can use. And one of the cool things you talk about was a biodegradable container made out of fungus. Could you talk about that for a second real quick, Lauren?
Sure. So this is a product that is made by a company called Ecovative Designs. And actually, it's not really a product. I should say it's more of a material. This company produces a material that's a combination of fungal hyphae, so sort of the roots of a mushroom, if you will, and seed husks. And it's a material that's completely biodegradable, and they use a certain chemical process with it that causes the fungi to produce basically a waterproof skin. And so I was just playing around with the idea of manufacturing some kind of planter like this in the book, where you can use it for a growing season and then break it down by hand, and it'll start to biodegrade and turn into basically the mulch for the next year's garden.
That's awesome. That's one of the great things that was in your book. And another crazy thing, I think all three of the guests can talk to this, and we don't have too much time, but the issue of bees and that how bees were disappearing, and you had a bee person in there, and it said that it's illegal in many states to harvest bees. Lauren, Adam, have you guys, has anybody else heard about this?
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Adam.
In Philadelphia, bees are, like, the only kind of animal you can legally keep in the city. Like, PHS is actually working to work with the city to get other livestock to be able to be legal in the city. But bees are legal, and it's amazing. They're so important. I mean, even this year, I've just noticed at the farm at the prison, there's just not bees around. And you need them so much for pollination purposes. I mean, it's just... you can't grow most of the crops. Think of like anything that's flowers, like tomatoes, cucumbers, squash, anything, without having it be pollinated by bees. So it's just really important that we keep our bee population high.
Mike, have you had any issue with bees?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that people don't realize is that there's also a lot of different pollinators. For instance, some stuff is pollinated by bats. Most people don't know that. A lot of trees are pollinated by bats. Butterflies, obviously, are really important, but there's lots of other pollinators. Beehive collapse is, I believe, personally, a big problem and is only going to get bigger. If you look at commercial farming now, there are people who their entire business is they have beehives that they move from farm to farm to farm during the growing season. And that used to be something that you planted your stuff, and the bees that were near your place, they did that work for you. So urban beekeeping, I think, is a growing and good trend. A lot of people do urban chickens. I'm not necessarily, me personally, crazy about chickens, but I think anything that you can do.
And in my book, I think we're all talking at the same time.
No, Lauren, go ahead. You say what you're
going to say. Yeah, sure. If I can jump in for a second, I just wanted to say that in my book I interviewed a wonderful urban apiarist named Trey Fleming, who has a company in Philadelphia, and he was explaining to me that, you know, he keeps both rural bees and urban bees, and he's been finding over the course of the past few years that his urban bees are much healthier than his rural bees because he finds that the bees out in the country fly through fields, through agricultural fields that are treated with pesticides. And the urban bees aren't exposed to those chemicals, and the populations are much stronger and more long-lived.
Another thing that I would throw out there that's probably going to be a growing trend is urban sheep herders and goat herders. And this is, it's not about wool and meat. It's actually about controlling invasive species. Being able to bring in a flock of goats to go to somewhere that's overgrown with kudzu or some other overlying thing, you can do a plan. They graze there. They turn everything into stuff that you can use to fertilize. And without using fossil fuels or machinery, you can clean out a lot of invasive plants. And so that's another
growing business
now. Lauren
talked about that. Yeah, that's something Lauren actually talked about. Adam, just real quick, we only have about a minute or so. Do you use bees or goats or rabbits? Something rabbits. Lauren talked about her book, rabbits. Do you use any animals to help with your farming, Adam?
No, we don't have anything now. But again, we're trying to lobby the city to make that legal. I mean, especially like I was saying about the goats. Like DHS manages like most of the vacant lots in the city. It mows them, keeps them nice, and it'd be so much easier with goats to tell the truth. Also, you know, it's good for when you're doing education and, like, with kids. You know, it's hard to get a kid interested in agriculture by, like, handing them a stalk of broccoli. But, like, getting involved with animals or, like, we're trying to promote more, like, fruit growing in the city because kids are more likely to kind of get into eating fresh food if they're something sweet and tasty rather than, you know, broccoli or something like that.
Right, right.
Petting a goat
I want to thank all of you guys.
Petting
a
weed whacker.
Right, that's true. I want to thank you guys for coming in, Lauren Mandel, author of Eat Up, Adam Hill from Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, and Mike Hill, another Hill, from the U.S. Forest Service Children's Program. Thank you all for calling in this morning, and I'm going to be giving away a copy of Lauren's book, so follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter or become a fan on Facebook. I'm also giving away a $25 Home Depot gift card, so you want to follow me. And maybe you can win one of these items. Thank you all for coming on this morning.
Thank you, Joy.
Thank you so much, Joy.
Thank you.
Thank you. And remember, you guys, don't forget to follow PHS_gardening. That's the Pennsylvania Horticultural Twitter site. Lauren Mandel. Her page is eatupag.com. Again, eatupag.com. And the U.S. Forest Service is a little long, so I'll just be tweeting that and posting that on Facebook. Pennsylvania Horticultural Society is phsonline.org. Again, phsonline.org. I thank you all for tuning in. Next Saturday, I'll be speaking with a former NBA player about how he overcame his injuries to become a millionaire, not just as a basketball player, but as an entrepreneur. So tune in next Saturday at the 20th at 11 a.m. for that. Have a wonderful Saturday. Have a wonderful week. And thank you again for tuning in.
We're here discussing child development with some experts. Tell me the normal development of, say, a two-year-old.
My truck.
So a child that age should know 2 to 4 word phrases. Good. And what about cognitive development? Ah, engaging in pretend play. I see. And what of social
Look, Anna!
Being enthusiastic about the company of other children. All right, thank you.
It's time to change how we view a child's growth. It's not just physical. There are milestones your child should reach in how he plays, learns, speaks, and acts. A delay in any of these areas could be a sign of a developmental problem, even autism. The good news is, the earlier it's recognized, the more you can do to help your child reach his full potential. Talk with a doctor, visit cdc.gov/act early, or call 1-800-CDC-INFO. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Learn the signs, act early.